On this episode of the Drummer Mindset Podcast, I sit down with Ted Marks. He's a musician, producer, and engineer based out of Asheville, North Carolina. If you've known him for a long time, you might have learned about him as a bass player. He used to play bass with Caitlin Crisco in The Broadcast. In the past few years, though, he's been sticking to drums because it was his first love. And so we talk a little bit about that transition, what that's been like. He also records and mixes for a number of musicians in the area. He's also got a project going on with Yaze in the pop group Two Coyote. And then you could also see him playing around town. He'll pick up gigs with Elon JD Trio when he's in town. And he also plays with Ashes and Arrows. I really enjoyed this conversation with Ted. And so I hope you do too. Right now, I just set up that drum set up here, the Yamaha.
Yeah.
And I can tell, like I'm listening now and I can hear the drums kind of talking back a little bit.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I do have those cool more kit. Open too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I don't know. Maybe we'll trade fours or something if you're into it.
Sure. I'm a lefty, so we'd have to spin.
Oh, okay.
We'd have to spin it around.
No problem.
I'm fully
That's
backwards.
Right. It's funny how being a right-handed player, like when I see a left-handed kit, there's no more drums on it than I'm used to seeing.
Right.
The cymbal setup is not that different, but when it's flipped, I'm just like looking at it like, what the hell's going on?
I know.
This dude must be a genius.
Man, to be honest, if I could go back in time, I would just be a right-handed drummer,
right,
or at least open-handed on a right-handed kit. The amount of times that I'm not able to sit in, or I'm making festival sound engineers angry because I have to like pull all the microphones off, switch the whole kit around, mic it back up. Yeah.
And also, like, there's so many amazing players that are left-handed folks that play right-handed kits.
Right, yeah.
I was just having this conversation the other day. I think Pridgen is one of those that
is
I learned.
He? Okay.
That's what Terrence Houston told me.
Okay.
And then Ringo. And
dang, I did not know that.
Yeah, now I'm like, yeah, I need to find, I think there's a lot more.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'd be interesting to go back and do the deep dive and see who is.
Right. You'll know by the ride cymbal because it'll be up with the hi-hat instead of
right
off to the right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, or they're so, like, you can't tell a difference between one side or the other, you know?
Right.
Like, they cross over just like they open hand, just like anything else. And
yeah.
That's the stuff that...
They can lead with their right hand for fills. That's why I was like, no way. I'm a left-handed drummer, because I couldn't... The thought of, like, trying to go around the kit with my right hand first and leading everything with the right hand was just like... Why would I do that? I can turn the drums around.
For sure.
But then, you know, 10 years down the road, I'm like, dang it. Why did I do that? Like, there's so many situations where if I were just playing a right-handed kit, life would be a lot easier.
And that, and Ringo got around that because that's, apparently that's why there's that gap. Like, he has space in his fills because he's like working around
he's
the kit.
Kind of catching up.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
So.
Dang. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I know that. That's what I've heard, you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah. Well, you know, I've heard a lot about you through Jazz Urias and through some other musicians in town. And I had not really gotten a chance to see you out because have you been gigging much in the past year or so?
I would say in the last like 2 years, I'm certainly not gigging as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
This year might be a little different. There's a band I started playing with called Ashes and Arrows.
Okay.
And they're getting tons of bookings right now.
Yeah.
So I think we're actually going to be playing Merlefest and some kind of cooler festivals this year.
And you play multiple instruments.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're playing drums with them?
Drums.
Okay.
So for the longest time, everybody only knew me as a bass player, except for my close friends, because when I'd have people over to jam, I was always playing drums. That was always what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And technically, I've been a drummer for longer than I've been a bass player.
Well, how long have you been a drummer?
Would be since I was in seventh grade. Well, I started learning percussion in sixth grade, so middle school, a long time.
11, 12, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I had a band in high school called Jazz the Ripper, and it was a terrible funk band. It wasn't terrible.
We were actually great. Did you grow up around here in Western Carolina?
Yeah, I grew up in Asheville, East Asheville. Yeah. So as far as the kid bands that were actually gigging, it was Jazz the Ripper and Skinny Legs and All, which was Jesse Berry's project. And they were another kid band, a little younger than us.
Okay.
But we were actually out gigging in high school, which was cool.
Where would you gig? Any place?
Tressa's. That was my first gig. I was 16 years old, and Tressa's was like my first real gig.
Gotcha.
But we got to do Belcher 1 year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We got some great opportunities, honestly, for being a kid band. You
and
know?
Belcher, for a lot of folks that have just been here in the past couple of years, was like the big festival.
Yeah.
Like, it really put Asheville on a map in, in a lot of ways. And fortunately, we've got AVL Fest now, and they're coming up on their second year.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's still different, though. It feels a little different.
It is different.
You know?
Yeah. Belcher was definitely like, it took over all of downtown.
Right.
There was vendors everywhere, stages set up on the streets everywhere. I mean, it was definitely a little more all-consuming than anything else that's happened.
Kind of a culture fair.
For sure.
You know, with arts and all different kinds of stuff.
Yep. Yeah. Lots of bands from out of town, too. That was huge. For me as a kid, that was like the thing to go do. And then we got to be a part of it, and that was awesome.
Yeah, that is awesome.
And then we've had... See, there was Expand Fest, which happened.
I'm not familiar.
That was a like 4 years back, maybe 4 or 5 years back. Yeah, I think that only happened 1 year. And then now AVL Fest, and they seemed to have gone really well. I think hopefully that's going to continue.
Yeah,
I know they're already doing it this year.
Yep.
So
yeah, I'm excited.
I got to play that last year. We did...
Who'd you play with?
It was Ashes and Arrows.
Oh, okay.
We played at the Wortham Center.
Nice.
Wortham Theater. It was always called Diana Wortham growing up.
Sure.
Now I don't... I think it's just called the Wortham Center now.
Okay.
But that was awesome. That was a cool room to play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Had you ever played that room before?
I hadn't, no.
Okay.
Yeah. No, that was my first time... not my first time in there, but first time playing there.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right.
It was fun. It was a very rushed situation. It's kind of funny, actually. We were sound checking, and we hadn't even got like halfway through the sound check, and the host, whatever you call them, they came out to introduce the band and name the sponsors and all that, and we were like, literally in the middle of sound check still, like. So she finished, got off the stage, like, welcome, Ashes and Arrows. And so one of the lead singers was like, hey, guys, so we've got to finish our sound check. We don't have vocals around yet. The piano, the guitar is like, we can't really play a show for you guys without finishing this. So hang out for a minute while we do this. So we awkwardly finished the sound check.
Yeah.
And then played, and it was great. It was a really good show and pretty decent crowd. And yeah. It was a good time.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, that's awesome to just like, I think for me, I definitely would have, you know, froze a little bit and felt, you would have felt pressure to begin performing, but you know, like, that's not how, you got a specific product you're trying to put out, an idea, the art, like your quality, you know, that you're trying to convey. So
sure.
Take
and
your time.
Yeah. And not even like, it wasn't like we needed all this extra time. It's just like we hadn't even gotten to our vocal mics yet. And that's like, if we don't hear vocals, we can't play the song.
Right.
It's not, it was just.
Yeah, it's lyrically driven music,
yeah,
right? Like absolutely. I've listened to them a bit. I mean, have y'all been together a long time?
They've been together for, I want to say about 2 years now.
Oh, wow.
Maybe. But I just started playing with them in the summer of this past year. So
they all sound pretty seasoned. Either way.
Thank you. Yeah. They are great. They're three great songwriters. They've put a lot of work in and they've hired some great musicians. Lots of good drummers have played before I was ever part of it too. The lineup is awesome now. It's I'm on drums, Trevor Stoya is on bass. And this new guy who moved to town from Texas maybe a year ago, Justin Roiland, phenomenal lead guitar player, probably one of my favorite lead guitar players in this town, and nobody knows him yet.
Oh, nice.
That's exciting. Right? Yeah. He does wedding cinematography, and he goes very deep into it, like incredible photography and, and film work.
Nice.
But yeah, stupid good guitar player. So he's on lead guitar, and yeah, it's a fun group.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you were, I kind of derailed you there, but we, you were talking about middle school.
Yeah.
Playing the drums.
Yep.
That's where it started.
Yes. Yeah.
And then at some point, like when did the kit come into play? Because it sounds like it was just primarily percussion or concert percussion.
Yeah. So, okay. Funny story. I'll back up a little bit. In fifth grade, I played the recorder like most of us. Right. I had a girlfriend in fifth grade who really wanted me to play clarinet with her in middle school. And of course, I and all my buddies were like, we were going to play drums. We wanted to be percussionists, whatever. So I did the boyfriend thing and played clarinet. I actually stuck with that for 7 years.
Okay.
And I had a love-hate relationship with it. I was embarrassed by it. You know, as a dude in middle school, I was like playing the clarinet. Not cool, right?
Yeah.
But I got pretty good at it quick, and so I was encouraged to keep going. Ended up doing tons of competitions with it.
Mm-hmm.
My high school toured Beijing for 2 weeks.
Cool.
And surrounding areas. But that was amazing. And the classical background really taught me a lot that I think I would be a different player if I didn't have that kind of influence. Not that I play classical music at all right now. It's just the reading capabilities, the musicality, the dynamics.
The tone.
Tone, playing with a lot of people, having a conductor, like all those skills were super valuable.
Because you strike me as someone, too, who's like, you can tell, like, I've seen you only play once, but like kind of going through and like seeing the records that you've been a part of and like who you've worked with, from Caitlin Crisco to all these like Ashes and Arrows that you've mentioned to some of Jazz Urias projects and stuff, like, because jazz, you can tell, it's like all tone too. Mm-hmm. And so, and it sound, and the way he described it, it was like y'all are like peas in a pod when it comes to that. It sounds like y'all share a taste and y'all understand a lot of that stuff. And so it always excites me when I see a drummer that gets involved in that, because I think for the first part of my drumming, like I understood it was a thing and I tried and I just got frustrated.
Sure.
So it was like, whatever it is what it is. I try not to make anything like too wrong, but it was not. It's also is expensive, right? So like when you're a kid trying to do all that stuff, and maybe that's a part of the, a good natural progression, like you kind of need to play a bunch of trash before you really know
absolutely
where to go.
Yeah. And you're growing your tastes, and hopefully you have a way to look back at what you just did and learn from it. I think every musician should be able to record themselves, not in a super high fidelity way, but at least a mic, even if it's just a USB mic, just something to get into the computer and listen back and critique yourself. And as a drummer, especially, dynamics across the kit is so important. And if you want your room mics to sound good, if you want your overhead mics to sound good, you have to sound good and balanced at the kit. You can't rely on, okay, well, I've got a kick mic and a snare mic and tom mics, and I'm close miking the hi-hats, and I've got some overheads. Like, you can, I guess, technically rely on just building a balance from your close mics, but it never sounds as good as your overheads.
Yeah.
If you're able to be balanced, you know, the cymbal volume, snare volume, kick volume, hi-hats, like all of it's so important to groove, to feel, but also to like the recording quality.
And would you say too, like that's true for almost any room you're in as far as like those overheads or the room mics or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd say like the smaller the room, you're going to get a better sound usually by playing quieter. We were talking about this kind of earlier, but sound pressure levels, like when you're putting a lot of volume into a room, it's gonna just build up and create kind of a mess. And the only way to fix that is to, like, you know, open a window or a door or let that sound escape. Even with that, though, when you have walls nearby, you're gonna have lots of sound buildup in smaller rooms. So if you can excite the room a little less, your recordings are gonna sound better, especially right. mics that are a little further away from the kit, like overheads and room mics.
Sure.
Close mics, definitely change with your room. A lot of guys like to put wood underneath their snare drum stand if they're on carpet, because it livens up the bottom head a little bit and makes your snare sound a little more brighter and open in a natural way.
And when you say like they put the whole stand on like a wooden platform, or you just can throw like a few pieces of wood under there?
Yeah, like you could just use plywood even and just make a circle or whatever and put your snare stand right on it.
So it's kind of so the legs are on the outside of it, but it just kind of reflects back.
Yeah, or like the legs will be on that platform. And obviously, if you have a tighter setup, it's harder to do this kind of thing. Uh-huh. And it could be a square or whatever. But any bit of wood just underneath the stand will make your snare sound a lot better in more treated rooms, especially where you have lots of carpet, lots of sound treatment. Mm-hmm. Just your dynamics, how you're the balance on the kit, I feel like stays fairly consistent whether you're playing quiet or loud or in a big room or a small room. It's super crucial, period. But
I was chatting with Jeff Hankin, who builds drums. He's got Carolina Drum Works.
Okay, I've heard of that, yeah.
And he was talking about playing for the room, and he was saying that typically you need to play louder than you think you do.
Mm.
And that's always like been opposite of what I've tried to do.
Yeah.
Because I always feel like it kind of, it feels like the drum's big responsibility. It can cover up everyone. So I oftentimes try to play a little bit softer.
Yeah.
And that was after years of playing too loud, like learning that.
Right.
Like, you get excited, you play faster and louder and all that kind of stuff. And then trying to like dial back and be more mature about it.
Right? Yeah. There's a time and a place. I mean, if you're playing a rock record and you're trying to play really quiet, the energy is not going to be there. There's no mixing that fakes energy. And that's especially true with vocals. I know that's kind of a side note, but like if you're not performing and giving the right emotion and attitude and energy, there's no mixing that can do that for you afterwards. There's no production move that can fake that performance.
Right.
And if you're playing a rock record and you're playing it really soft, trying to get that excitement and energy afterwards in a mix is going to be really difficult.
Yeah.
But I think it's all dependent on the room you're in, the style of music you're trying to play, and just your own personal tastes. But I will say, from someone who's recorded a lot and mixed quite a lot, if you're bashing your cymbals and you're in a smaller room, you're going to struggle mixing that later.
Yeah.
It's that bleed into other mics is not easy to deal with.
Yeah.
Well,
so yeah, a little bit of context too, because I mean, I don't think I know everything that you've been involved with, but clearly, like, you've played and recorded for Caitlin Crisco in the broadcast.
We just finished mixing another song.
Nice.
Yeah.
Did that release already? Is it Blue Friday?
Blue Monday.
Blue Monday.
That's been out for a while. Okay. And then I also mixed Devil on Your Side.
Uh huh.
And then the new one that's coming out is Pieces of You.
Okay.
Yes.
Nice.
I don't know what the release date is. I literally just finished the mix this past week.
Okay.
So it still has to be mastered, and then they'll probably figure out a plan for the release on that.
Well, tell me about your background and clearly we're kind of getting there. Like, you're playing the clarinet.
Yeah.
You're picking up on tone. You're picking up on the orchestration of everyone.
Yeah.
And it's obviously like you're taking in whatever the conductor's doing, and you're seeing how it all needs to fit.
Yeah.
But you've also got this mind for percussion at the same time. So like you've got like two different worlds
going on. Honestly, I kind of had like four worlds all combined at once. Clarinet was first. And then in seventh grade, my dad passed away when I was young, and my sister held on to his acoustic guitar.
Okay.
And so I got that in seventh grade. So then I was learning how to play guitar. But the whole time I was playing clarinet, I wanted to be a percussionist. I wanted to be a drummer. So then I think it was Christmas of seventh grade, I got a drum set.
Okay.
And then a little later on, when I started in high school, when I started playing with that funk band, Jazz the Ripper, at first, it was just three of us, and we all could kind of play guitar, and we're all drummers.
Okay.
None of us were bass players, but we obviously needed bass, uh-huh. you know? So every song we would switch off on who was playing what instrument. Uh-huh. And then after, like,
no one wanted to play bass.
And no one wanted to play bass. Drums. Everyone wanted to play drums. Yes. And me and one of the other guys especially were definitely guitar players, so uh-huh. we were kind of okay with that too. But I think at the end of the day, truly all of us wanted to be the drummer.
Uh-huh.
It didn't take too long for us to realize who was definitely the best drummer. And so he took that role, my buddy Jordan Arnold.
Okay.
So he took that role. Daniel played guitar, my other buddy, and I was like, cool, I'll be the bass player. Why not?
Okay.
I fell in love with it.
Nice.
Still play drums all the time, but that was like my first band where I was really playing, and I fell in love with bass, uh-huh. went down that whole rabbit hole.
Uh-huh.
I still play all the time.
Yeah.
Recording. I don't take gigs on it anymore.
Why not?
And that, so yeah, that kind of comes back to earlier. So
you just like to carry more shit onto stage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I like to struggle a little more. No. I always wanted to be a drummer, and I was a drummer first.
Uh-huh.
But I never really had the opportunity to go play in a band. Got
it. So it's your season for it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And so it was like 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. I actually made a Facebook post,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, for the time being, I'm not taking any more bass gigs. I want to go play drums. I've been playing drums for a long time. This is when I want to take gigs on. And it took a few months. You know, I still got quite a lot of calls for bass, and I just kind of kept turning them down. And letting them know, like, hey, I'm not taking bass gigs, but next time you need a drummer, think of me.
Okay.
And now I only get drum calls. I mean, there's a rare occasion where sometimes I'll get a bass yeah. call. Yeah. But it was just time. It was time for me to do really what I wanted to be doing.
What has your time on bass taught you, or how has it changed the way you play drums?
I mean, I think both roles are so crucial for each other. Mm-hmm. Not overplaying, which I still struggle with sometimes. I think all of us drummers, especially, we like to play fills. We like to uh-huh. chop up a little bit.
But you got a good pocket.
Yeah. And being a bass player, I know what I wanted from a drummer.
Uh-huh.
And being a drummer, I knew what I wanted from a bass player.
And did you play with Michael Davis when you were playing with the broadcast?
Yeah, I played with Michael Davis for like 2 months, maybe.
And Jazz was the drummer for a bit, too. Right?
Yeah, Jazz was right after that. Uh-huh. So when I joined that band, Michael was kind of already on his way out. I think mm-hmm. that was already the plan.
Okay.
I got to play, like, my first run with him, we did Bear Creek Music Festival,
mm-hmm.
and it was insane. Uh-huh. I was like, whoa. Like,
yeah.
I can't believe I'm doing this. And then, yeah, Jazz came along after a couple months. And that was awesome. I played with that band for another year or so,
uh-huh.
maybe two. My memory's not great, but
it's all right.
And then, yeah, he played a little longer than me, and Elon came on bass after I left that band.
Gosh, I guess I missed that part.
Yeah.
Okay. There's so much.
And Elon played with him for a while. Yeah, he went to Europe with him. They did a lot of touring together.
Right on.
Elon is another really good friend of mine.
Oh, nice. And yeah. an amazing musician. Super yeah. nice guy. Yeah, I love watching him play bass.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever seen anyone play bass quite like the way he does it.
He's special.
Yeah.
He really is. Yeah. yeah. And his own music is really cool, too. I produce all of his records,
okay.
too, or all of his singles.
Uh-huh.
I think the latest batch of music is going to become a record.
Nice.
So that's awesome. He put a song out not too long ago from the new stuff.
Yep.
Great singer, new to singing, really, publicly.
Is he really?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's been singing his whole life, you know,
sure.
but going out and performing,
uh-huh.
you know, I think that's fairly new for him still.
Yeah.
And it's just awesome. Like, even from 2 or 3 years ago to now, like, his growth vocally is crazy.
Yeah.
And he just writes really cool music, too. Like, bass player writing songs, it's just different, you know. They're not coming from typical guitar chords,
right,
or piano. It really is a lot about the bass, and then bass and vocals. He's had some great drummers on it. I've been fortunate to do a lot of the drums lately for uh-huh. his stuff. It's just super fun.
Yeah,
fun
one of my favorite shows that I've seen, just local. It was like a gig just for the locals. It was like middle of the week kind of a thing, or maybe even a Monday. And it was at Five Walnut Wine Bar. And it was just him and Jazz.
Oh, cool.
And so Jazz also has that melody perspective too, yep. but also the rhythm and can sing. And so like them back and forth was just like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This is different. And it's just a two-piece. But
I wish I had saw that.
Yeah, it was great. And the fascinating thing is like what I just recently learned, like River Gagarin, we were talking about kind of the trance like state that you can find in music. And he's like basically usually like three different perspectives or tones, you know, or instruments really helps you kind of get there. And he's like, you can capture that in a lot of ways. And he was talking about even in hip hop music, you can catch that. You know, if you just got kind of the MC or just the drums and like maybe some little melody that's going on in the back. And then you've some got the lyrical, the lyrical aspect. Like that's it. You can find that trance.
Yeah.
But the way that they did it, it was, you had much more than three going on.
Right.
And I mean, obviously the drums, you've usually got several things going on, even when you got like a pared down kit, like Jazz often plays.
Right. Right.
But then you got, you know, he can do the high, then he's got a huge range.
Yeah.
And then also Elon with his perspective is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I see that more.
Someone told me recently, Prince had a big thing about when he's recording a song and writing a song, you need to be able to solo two of the elements and it feel great.
Okay.
So at any point, however, if you've got 10 things going on, that's fine, but you should be able to pick two of them and it always feel really good and sound good. It's just two of the elements. That was kind of his rule. Like, and if it wasn't working, if any two elements didn't feel great together, then it wasn't right and they needed to change something.
Wow.
But yeah, Jazz and Elon, I love those guys.
Yeah.
They're both so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good people too.
Yeah. Really
good people.
Yeah. Yeah. I know Jazz a little bit more than Elon, but every time I mean, Elon's always been super nice and, you know, easy to talk to, but, well, cool. Okay, so you had four different worlds going on.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. Clarinet, acoustic guitar, drums, and then bass. Mm-hmm. And all of that kind of came together. In a way, I think it maybe dampened my ability to become really, really good at one of those things.
Okay.
But at the same time, I think it was really beneficial for the sake of like music and the song that I was learning all these different things and different approaches and different sides of what combines to make something a song.
And that's
I'm
huge.
Not unhappy about it. Yeah, right, yeah, for sure.
Because I think I find myself on the other end of like, you know, primarily drums, having taken piano lessons, trumpet, you know, and then more recently trying to pick up bass. But I just keep, you know, it's helpful in a way. Like I'm seeing now where you need to try to leave space and where like the bassist, you never really think about the bassist. You always feel like, and I think this happens a lot, like, okay, when the bass solo comes on a lot of times, you'll hear the drummer kind of go off too.
Right.
And I've learned like, it's so frustrating for the bassist because they can't really shine. And even though I think a lot of it comes from the fact that when you're the drummer, you always feel the bass and you love the bass, so you get so much energy from it that when it goes off, it's like, yeah, I'm going to go with
you. Let's go. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, like let them kind of provide the palette here.
Especially to start.
Yeah.
I think depending on the solo and the vibe, like later on, you know, it's as a bass player and a drummer, like I want someone to kind of get there with me. I don't want it. Not always. I don't want just like, okay, drummer goes down to rim clicks, quiet, and I'm just going to solo over 32 bars or whatever, and then just be done with it. Like at some point, I do want dynamics to grow with me. And if I'm repeating a rhythmic pass or melody, like pick up on it and go with me. Yeah. As a bass player, one of my favorite things to do is to find little moments with the vocal in a recording and sync up and play the vocal line just for a second.
Yeah.
If it's just the end of the phrase, just kind of get there for a second and then go back to playing my role, you know?
Right.
But drums too, like I'm always listening for when it comes to arrangement and parts, like how can I make it feel like we're all playing this together and accenting together and making little moments versus this is the drum groove and that's all it's going to be the whole time. Like
right.
verse two, maybe there's a cool little moment. Like let's all hit that. Let's mm-hmm. make something out of it. So,
yeah. And so then how did you get into more of the sound engineer mixing role? Like,
I think
when did that happen.
Yeah. So, I went to Berklee College of Music for a year. Mm-hmm. And when I got up there, I immediately became
was
obsessed.
This in Boston?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I immediately became obsessed with recording. Mm-hmm. The studios at that college are incredible. Mm-hmm. The gear was insane. I was also fortunate to, I kind of signed on a little late. So the dorms were already full. And that meant I had to find housing outside of campus.
Okay.
And there's a whole forum for Berklee students to find roommates, mm-hmm. you know, outside of dorms. And I found these two juniors who were incredible bass players, and we got a place together. And honestly, between those two guys and just the friends and other musicians that I met at that school, that was more valuable than the school itself.
Right.
Especially, I think now it's like $60K a year to yeah. go there. It was, I think it was like 50 when I was there, which is crazy. I mean, yeah. I really think you could almost just move to Boston and hang out with Berklee kids
yeah.
and learn almost as much.
I think
not saying the classes aren't worth it. There was some really good stuff that I
right.
learned. And I got to study with Lincoln Goyens, he's kind of an OG fusion bass player, mm-hmm. God, you know, I mean, learned a ton from him. So I'm not saying the school was useless, but
right.
the students.
I think yeah. that's true for so many fields of study in general. I mean, obviously there's certain things that are very technically focused that are hard to capture outside of a school situation,
yeah.
you know, just for credentialing or whatever that's required for it. But at the same time, I think Paul Gladstone had a similar kind of story to
okay.
you. Like he hung out with a bunch of music students
yeah.
And like, but didn't go to school, but he was just hanging out with all those folks.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you listen to Paul play anything.
Oh yeah. It's
I mean,
great.
Any instrument, like it's clear. Like
one day we're going to do something together.
Yeah,
we've talked about
awesome.
It so much and just haven't made it happen yet.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. I love that guy.
Yeah. But yeah. And I think, yeah, I think really that is the benefit so much of college. It's not is like the thing that I think the best piece of advice that I've ever heard was that school is really just kind of, it's an opportunity to show. You get that piece of paper to show that you know how to navigate a bureaucracy.
Right.
And so that's kind of where it goes from there. Otherwise, you have to learn how to learn despite bad teachers sometimes or conditions or whatever. And there's always turnover.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it is like here, I navigated that bureaucracy. I can probably navigate yours.
Yeah.
And be hireable, you know?
Yeah. And I will say like my plan eventually, I only went for the 1 year.
Uh-huh.
My plan was to do a double major, go into music production and engineering and then electronic production and design. I was going to go all in the recording world and music creation.
Uh-huh.
And I ended up touring after the first year of going there. And so I was kind of like, I don't need to go into almost $200,000 of debt.
Right.
This is really what I wanted to do at that time, more than recording.
Who were you touring with then?
It was that same Jazz the Ripper. It was that same funk band. Yeah.
Okay.
After a year of college, Joe Hamilton, the saxophone player, which, side note, he's been in New Orleans for a while. He just brought his band up to record with me
nice.
A couple weeks ago. So that was cool. I haven't seen him in a super long time.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, he was like, I got all these dates. Like, let's go. Let's play. And I'm like, cool. Let's do it.
It really seems like there's a strong connection between, there's a lot of New Orleans musicians in Asheville that
mm-hmm.
just kind of float back and forth.
Yeah. Who was I talking to? I was talking to somebody recently. And they were talking about how similar the two cities are in a way, as far as like musicians and the grind and the pay for a lot of like just classic bar gigs and
right.
stuff like that. It's very similar.
Right.
Hopefully you get lots of tips,
right.
that kind of thing. But yeah, there's tons of great players here from New Orleans. Joshua Lee, do you know him? Killer drummer.
I don't know him. I've seen him on, I think, Instagram.
Yeah. Great
drummer. So he's definitely on the radar. But yeah.
super nice dude, great drummer. He was in New Orleans. I don't know if he's from there, but he was there for a long time.
Quinn Sternberg. Do you know him?
No, I don't.
Oh, yeah. He's a bassist that just moved up here from New Orleans.
Okay.
He's touring around a lot. He's got his own music that he puts out, but he's playing with a lot of different folks. I think he's playing with Rachel Waterhouse these days.
Okay, cool.
But
I do.
You got to meet that
producing
dude.
And mixing all of her stuff, too.
Okay.
Pretty much, yeah.
But yeah, you got to meet him. He's cool. Super nice guy.
Nice.
Awesome.
What was his name?
Player. Quinn.
Quinn. Okay, cool.
Quinn, yeah. I'll send you his link.
Yeah.
But yeah. But yeah, so yeah, there's that connection, which is exciting to kind of see, you know, because you just know, like, there's like, I think I moved here originally like a long time ago, realized like partly for the music scene and everything else that people move to Asheville for, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know that it was, I either wasn't as aware or didn't have the money to go to see as many shows. Or whatever was going on.
Yeah.
And then moved away for a bit, came back and knew that, you know, it's still a music scene, but like it was just kind of one little piece that I understood before I started this project and kind of like venturing out and stuff and just seeing everybody that comes around here and all different styles of music and like the different families that you'll kind of see collecting is pretty exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. The music community is great here.
Do you feel like you grew up here. Do you feel like it's always been the case?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I was invited to gigs before I was allowed to actually go to them. Ben Bjorley was a huge inspiration for me when I was younger. He sold my mom my first bass. Are you familiar with Ben Bjorley?
It sounds so familiar, but tell me.
He's a bass player and a drummer. And we both played clarinet when we were in school. So we had that kind of bond there. But
that hardship bond.
Yeah. I forgot where
Ben Bjorley was a big influence for you growing up. So yeah, it's just obviously
the music community.
Like
yeah.
A lot of folks that you kind of looked up to.
Yeah, yeah. So like when I was a kid, Joey K, rest in peace. Yeah. Love that guy. Uh-huh. He was huge. Ben Bjorley was another guy. Uh-huh. They both worked at the same music store and
it was down there in East Asheville. So pretty close to where you grew up, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. It was called Music Center at the time. Yeah. Now it's Music 1, 2, 3.
Music Arts.
Music and Arts.
Yeah.
That's what it is now.
Yeah. So was Joey ever a teacher of yours?
He wasn't.
Okay.
No. Stupidly of me. I should have taken lessons with him. But no, those guys were just always inviting me out. Like there was a band called Lotion back in the day. And it was Joey K, Rob Geisler, and Dwayne Simpson, who's phenomenal. They're all three incredible players. And he'd be like, yeah, you got to come out. It's like, dude, I'm 16 or 17. Like, I can't go to the bar and see your gig, or else I would be there. I was allowed to play Tressa's at 16. That was my first gig.
Right.
But during our set breaks, we had to go out back and hang out outside. We weren't allowed to be in the bar at all, which was fine with me. I'm like, whatever, I get to play a gig downtown. You know, I was happy about it. But
yeah.
Growing up here, I think, also has given me a lot of opportunities and word of mouth. I mean, my whole business is based off of word of mouth, just from knowing people from being here for so long.
Right.
And Asheville is already huge into supporting local. And so that kind of helped me as well, just because friends are like, hey, I liked working with him. You should go record with him or hire him for your thing. And so that's been super beneficial.
Did you ever get tied to a specific like sound studio that you would go and do this kind of work with folks, or you just like go to different ones?
I started working out of a room. It wasn't my bedroom, but when I started doing it professionally, I had a really kind of janky home studio set up and made it work. A lot of the stuff I did that kind of helped me get the work I'm still getting was done in a very put together kind of bedroom studio. It wasn't my bedroom, but just a room in the house. And I just, you know, I didn't let my gear or my space hold me back. You know, I tried to make sure that I was doing as ideally like just as good of quality as anything you'd hear on the radio and figuring out whatever I had to do to get it there. And that definitely was not the case for a lot of stuff I did at first.
Sure.
Every year you become better at what you do, and if I were to go back to the first stuff I ever mixed, I'd probably cry a little bit, you know, just because you're like, dang.
You're right.
I did that and someone paid for that and they were okay with it. Like, okay. But, you know, that's just part of learning. And
yeah. So you had those two bass players that you roomed with in Boston. Were like big mentors for you, it sounds like. You had those mentors early as well.
Yep. And are you familiar with Matt Garsko?
Yeah.
He was a presidential scholar when I was there at Berkeley.
Okay.
He was good friends with one of those roommates, Steve Nishimura. He was one of the bass players that I lived with.
Gotcha.
So Matt would come over. And so I got to see today one of the greatest drummers that's alive right now, in my opinion.
No kidding.
I got to see him play all the time and hang out with him.
That's cool.
And I didn't get to take lessons with him. I was going there for bass. I wasn't going there for drums.
Uh-huh.
But I had my whole kit set up. And that's kind of where I started recording. Was I just wanted to be able to make songs, so I got a cheap little Tascam interface, and that's kind of where my start was with recording. But
you're not responsible for that connection with. I mean, not that Elon or John Scales needs any help with like connection, but that must have been kind of exciting for you to see John Scales play with Animals as Leader.
Absolutely,
for a few shows, I think they did.
I think they did a whole
like
run
a tour.
With him.
Yeah.
When Elon told me, I was like, oh my God, dude, you're never going to believe this.
Yeah.
I know the drummer, Matt. And
yeah.
He was phenomenal. I mean, so he came from a fusion background. Uh-huh. His dad is a killer fusion guitar player.
Okay.
And this guy, Joe, I can't remember his last name, bass player, they had a really cool thing going for Matt, like as he was growing up. But my second semester at Berkeley, they decided to do a metal ensemble, and they had tons of ensembles. I got to play in the Bob Marley ensemble. Like, cool. There's tons of really cool ensembles that you could audition and be a part of. So Matt Garza, coming from like the fusion world, he was like, sure, let's try the metal thing.
Uh-huh.
And I remember he got a double kick pedal, and I think he had some experience with double kick before, but he was mainly a single kick dude.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, I'm going to get into metal. I'm going to audition for this thing. Let's start working. And that guy was playing rudiments at speeds that I couldn't even imagine doing with my hands, right. But he was doing it with his feet.
Right.
And from that point on, I was like, oh, this guy, he's going to be one of the greats. And sure enough, now he's, I think it was maybe a year or so after he finished Berkeley that he joined Animals as Leaders.
Uh-huh.
Maybe two. It wasn't too long. And now here he is today.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, that would have been a cool show to catch because, I mean, John Scales, just the percussive element that they have going on.
Right.
Is unmatched.
And I think they did a little bit of sit-ins. I think Jonathan
did.
Got to play with them a little bit. And,
yeah. So Mason Guidry and Matt Gartzka on one bill. Because Mason is.
I don't know if they played together at all, but I would pay
a
lot of money
to see
them
trade fours, dude.
Oh, man.
That would be incredible.
Yeah, Mason is another absolute alien.
Yeah,
just
truly.
Yeah.
No one else plays like that.
Way
dude.
Over my head. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Nick Hope told me about like meeting with him for a bit and just like trying to get a lesson. And he's like, the only thing he got from his question, his main question was like, how do you solo over all these different time signature changes constantly?
Right.
And Mason was like, oh, you just need to practice. You get really good at your singles. Just do singles over all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they moved on to talking about Star Wars or something. He's like, they ended up not really doing like a lesson, but they just like kind of like bonded, you know, over this like online lesson or whatever. And just.
That's funny.
Yeah. What a showman too. I mean, just, you know, the drums are like,
I mean.
Like all these, yeah, it's definitely all these marching, you know, drum tricks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But he doesn't miss a beat with it, you know?
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
His attack, too, is just nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, he means every note he plays. And
definitely. Yeah. He has conviction. Mm-hmm. Like it's all on purpose for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So bass you lay into heavily, and like you said, like you're now in the season, and it's just been in the past couple of years, you're in the season of the drum.
So yeah, like 4 or 5 years now.
Uh-huh.
I think I made the move of like, this is really what I want to be doing. Uh-huh. Not that I didn't want to play bass. I was just a drummer first, and I really wanted to be doing that the whole time, more than anything else. And so I was kind of like, you know what, let's just force this. Uh-huh. And now, yeah, that's all I'm doing really as far as gigs go. Recording is different. I still record lots of bass, but
Yeah, it's fascinating, you know, just thinking about the whole microphone world and like how you get into that and how it makes so much sense to me now. Like, whereas before I would just, you know, I just never even really paid attention. Like, we were fortunate enough to have a sound guy, a sound engineer for the band that I played in college and stuff. And he's incredible. And he continued on that path and did it professionally for a while and stuff. But, you know, so we were super lucky. And I just go back and I think back, I was like, man, I should have paid more attention.
Right. You
know? But yeah, like, because it is a whole different thing. And I think it can be daunting for a lot of folks, you know, because it is like, to me, it's always like, okay, what kind of gear? Like, if I've got a bit of money, it's like,
and it's okay, endless.
A microphone or a new cymbal, or like, how does that, you know, how do you decide?
I constantly struggle with that.
This is your dilemma.
I have an addiction, and the addiction is gear. It's not the healthiest addiction out there, but you know, I do try to be pretty specific about having some sort of priority to what I'm getting. But the list is never ending, you know. Like, especially for someone who records, that's my main living, and so it's like, you want to be able to provide all sorts of stuff for bands and artists that come in. So I'm kind of always like I got a new electric guitar recently, and it's like, I need to have a pro electric guitar for myself, but also for clients. And if somebody needs a different tone, it's like, here, use this Fender Jazzmaster.
Right.
Like, and that's, I love that guitar. But, another one on my list is like, a nylon string guitar. That's just another sound that is so unique and special.
Sure.
And I should have it, you know?
Yeah.
Keyboards, that's a whole other world that maybe down the road I'll get into, but I'm not a piano player. I want to be.
Yeah.
To an extent. I don't need to be out gigging on piano, but yeah, so as far as gear, it's like constant new drum stuff, cymbals, obviously, crazy expensive, you know,
snare,
for high-end cymbals, snares. And then the audio world, because there's always more tools you can buy. And for the longest time, because of money, really, I was like, oh, just record clean, get it in, and I can do whatever I need to in post. And that's certainly true. Like, if you've got a good space and your drums sound good, or whatever you're recording sounds good and you're playing it well, you can record with really cheap stuff and get great mixes at the end of the day.
The
That's
raw
not going to hold you
is
back.
Good, right.
Yeah. But I will say, a lot of times when I'm recording, I also end up mixing that session most of the time. If somebody's hiring me for recording, they're also hiring me to mix it. So these days I'm more into getting gear that's going to get me closer to the finish line.
Yeah.
So if I can kind of, if I can get in before it even gets to the computer, already sounding great, not raw, just a little more processing stuff I would do later on, then it's just going to save me time later, and it sounds great. I mean, analog gear is still around for a reason.
Yeah.
It's, you can't beat real tubes.
Yeah.
Being able to EQ something on the way in with analog EQ. I got a piece recently from Neve. It's called like the 542, and it's a tape emulator, but it actually has two tape heads inside of the unit. So it's certainly not the same thing as a real tape machine, but it's really close to the same sound. There's no maintenance. It's not this big machine you have to keep in perfect condition.
Right.
It's just a little 500 series unit. But anyway, so there's that whole world of just more gear, getting stuff to sound great before it gets in there. Also, for a client, like my vocal chain, I've invested a lot of money into that.
Yeah.
So when I have a singer over, they should be really stoked about what they're hearing before it even touches the computer.
Okay.
And that's great for them. It's great for the performance that I'll get from them.
Yeah.
But it also saves me time later because I'm already closer to the finish line.
Yeah.
In the sound of it.
And the vocals, I mean, every instrument is like personal to the individual or the musician or whatever, but especially like vocals, right? Like it's a different thing. Like, you don't need to technically be good to sound great.
Yeah.
And it's also part of that fingerprint and part of what makes the whole sound.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's not going to be a cookie cutter situation for every vocalist.
No, no. I mean, I have kind of my go-to mic that I usually start with. But I definitely, I'm a big fan of just having the singer go through the whole song a couple of times and letting them know beforehand, like, hey, we're not keeping any of this. Don't count on any of this. This is for me to hear things, make changes, decide if the mic is maybe not the right choice for the song or the range. Like some singers, if they're really quiet and in a kind of softer, maybe the middle of their range, I might go for a more high fidelity tube condenser. But then somebody who's screaming, I'm going to use the SM7B, you know, something like this.
Yeah.
Something that can handle a huge dynamic range. But then also just the octave, the range that you're singing in. Like sometimes when you're higher up, there's some certain mics that sound better for you. And that doesn't mean that mic is also going to work for the next song where you maybe are singing lower.
Right.
But it's all just a taste thing too. There's no right and wrong. It's just, what do you think sounds good in the moment? What do you think is doing the best job for the song or the singer? And just going with that.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's not the right decision and you take care of it in the mix, hopefully, and figure out how to make it work.
Do you find many mentors these days? Like folks that you're like calling up, say, hey, I've got this problem going on. What do you recommend?
I'm not, I wish I did have a little more, I wish I had more people like that. YouTube is incredible though.
True.
There's so much out there.
Right.
And a lot of what I know, I learned from YouTube and videos and mixing engineers that I love their work. I'll find their YouTube videos.
Sure.
You also have lots of guys who make videos about other engineers and they've done the work. They've watched 30 videos and now they're creating a list for you of like, here's the 7 best techniques I learned from all the different videos that are out there from this guy.
Right.
And it's just cool. I mean, I'm constantly trying to take new information in.
Yeah.
It's a never ending learning process. And your tastes change, your everything changes with time.
Sure.
So if you look at my YouTube right now, it's all pretty much all about audio stuff.
Yeah.
I do feel like I'm in a place where I know quite a bit about it and I feel confident when I'm working. I'm not ever really in a position of like, what's the best way to go about this?
Right.
But there's new engineers all the time coming out with creative techniques. There's new tools coming out.
Right.
It's just never ending. Yeah.
With some of the other recording projects, I think that you've been a part of, like Caitlin Crisco, Jim Scott.
Yeah. So I was the bass player on that record with Jim Scott. That was a really cool experience.
So, and he's produced for a ton of folks, right?
Yeah. He basically worked under, Rick Rubin.
Okay.
He was like the dude. So, what he told us, at least, is that when a band would come in, he'd set up the whole session and get sounds, and they'd start tracking. And once things sounded good, then he could call Rick to come in. But Rick would kind of wait, and he wouldn't be there making all the little small decisions. He's a big picture guy.
Right.
So Jim Scott was a big part of the sound of a lot of those big, big records that he wasn't really credited for, maybe in the best way, but it was also his job. You know, he's hired to be the assistant for this guy,
right?
And so that's just part of the industry, I guess.
Yeah.
Working with him was really cool, though. It was in this massive warehouse in Valencia, California, which is just a little outside of LA. And the first room that you walk into was just full of vintage keyboards. Drums all the way up the walls, everything you could ever imagine there. And then he had some smaller ISO rooms and we tracked in a smaller space and his control room. And that was just, walking in was inspiring. Just all the gear and the way they had it look in there too was just really cool.
Yeah, just the options. I imagine, just as a gearhead, it's like, yes, obviously, like, there's some
I played utility. My Mexican P-bass on the whole record, pretty much. I think there was one song I used I used a Rickenbacker for a song, and there's some weird bass I used for something else. But okay. Outside of that, it was all my...
I love a P bass.
$500 bass, yeah. Maybe. And it sounds killer. It still sounds awesome on the record. Yeah.
That's also a good lesson, right? Yeah. Sometimes what you have is what you've bonded to, and you know how to make it sound right, as opposed to learning some new instrument all of a sudden.
Yeah. And also a P bass, it's like... That's on so many records. There's a reason
right.
It works.
It's like a supraphonic.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
For sure. Awesome, dude. Well, and so you're looking at touring or gigging more right now with Ashes and Arrows. Mm-hmm. Clearly, you're picking up gigs with friends, like seeing you with Elon JD recently.
Yeah, that was the first time I've done something like that in a while, actually.
Oh, nice.
A pickup gig kind of
like
that.
It was great.
It was fun. Very unprepared. Kind of just going for it.
Had you played in that room before?
No.
What did you think?
It was a really cool space.
Uh-huh.
For me, as a drummer, like you were saying earlier, you tend to think that the drums are way too loud. And so I definitely was struggling a little bit with like everything I was playing and trying to have chops and whatever mm-hmm. I would normally have at a normal volume, trying to think about having all that really quiet and doing it well, I was really struggling with. And the funny thing is the whole time Elon is looking over like, you can play louder. Like, you're good. Like, play louder. And I'm like, are you sure? It's crazy loud where I'm at. Like, the drums were just blasting. And I felt like even my quietest hit was loud.
Did you have no monitors?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just bass amp kind of next to me and the Eli Kahn, his guitar amp after that.
Yeah.
And Elon did have a monitor for his vocal in front of him.
Uh-huh.
And then he has like the Bose Towers for the front of house.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Had you played with Eli Kahn before? He's kind of new to
the
area.
No, he's been in my studio. We've done a little bit of writing.
Yeah.
But no, that was the first gig I had played with him.
Nice. He's so great.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He's in so many different projects, too.
He really is.
He's such a great dude.
I think he told me he's got like 5 different projects going on right now.
I just ran sound for him at Sierra Nevada on Saturday.
Oh, I was so sorry to miss that. Yeah.
That was a cool show.
Oh, Joe Enright has just got great energy on the drums.
Love Joe. He's a drummer who can play those quieter rooms and crush it.
Yeah.
His dynamics are so good. His abilities at that really low volume.
Yeah.
I'm jealous.
Yeah. Also, he knows how to bring it up too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He was just in here last week.
Nice.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I love that dude.
Yeah. He's great. But cool. Well, yeah. So you'd mentioned it before. You've got your YouTube channel. You're pretty active on Instagram as well. I can link to those, but talk about your YouTube channel a little bit.
I don't actually have a YouTube
channel. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Two Coyote, we've got our little channel, which is Jazz Areas and my project, which is, I love that project. That's kind of, pop music for me was kind of a guilty pleasure for a long time.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I almost didn't want to admit that I loved it so much, but I really do. I love pop music. But we have a group, and we have 2 songs out, and unfortunately, like, you got to make money and you got to take in work. And I am known to not really take days off.
Yeah.
So I book myself like crazy.
Is that right?
It's great because it's bringing money in.
Sure.
But I've made a goal for 2024 to put more time towards projects that I'm a part of that have nothing to do with money. I just want to write and produce stuff that I really want to be a part of, as well as still make money and do that whole thing too. But Jazz and I have another song finally after way too long, and that's all my fault, not on Jazz at all. The song could have been out so long ago, but I was like, what if we did like shreddy guitar licks over the end of it, and like it's still a pop tune, but there's little like hint of maybe like what a live pop band would do, because a lot of really big pop bands, the live arrangements
shredders.
Are incredible,
right.
And they're shredding on stage.
Yeah.
I was like, what if we throw a little bit of that in there? And so I took forever with it. And we finally finished it, and I think it's coming out in March.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know the date. I'd have to look
on
DistroKid. But so this year, definitely trying to do more of that stuff. Jazz is actually coming over on Wednesday, finally. So
okay.
We're trying to prioritize some time for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, because he's gigging a lot right now too with a couple of different people, and then producing and doing the things he does, like creative types, right? Like y'all are just trying to get it all in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And sometimes I wish I gave myself a little more time off, to be honest, you know, but it's just the name of the game.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's I struggle. If I have a day off, I'm not sitting around. I'm like,
you rest like a shark, huh? Still moving.
Yeah.
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 What else would you be doing? Would you end up finding yourself in the studio or next to an instrument if you took a day off?
Pretty much. Yeah. Like sometimes, like days off, which are rare, it's usually only like maybe half a day that I have off. Yeah. And I'll clean the house, you know, stuff like that. But then it's hard for me to not at some point go to the studio.
Yeah.
And even if it's just playing drums for an hour or working on mixes, I kind of always have work that needs to be done.
Right.
So, yeah, it's hard to be like, I'm just going to take this day and not do anything when I know there's 20 things I could go do.
Right.
That are going to bring money in. You know, it's hard to just sit around.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking the time for this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
That's cool. Never done anything like it. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Cool.